Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We appreciate that. Please follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just type in the Union Edge. You know, folks, we often talk on this program about just telling the truth. We know that being a shock jock, being somebody just trying to, you know, raise people's blood pressure and the hackles in the front and the back of their neck, it isn't how we communicate. It isn't how we get it done. To talk about just a cool exterior and demeanor when facing the lion's den, we have Professor Carla Katz from Rutgers University. Professor Katz, welcome to Union Edge.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, appreciate it very much. Thank you. You are a labor professor at Rutgers University. Talk to us about your labor program just a little bit.
Sure. We have a wonderful school for labor and management relations at Rutgers. That's one of the top labor schools in the country. And we have both sort of labor extension programs, meaning we do labor education with unions and workers, as well as a bachelor's, master's, and PhD program that are all very successful. So it's a, you know, New Jersey's a highly unionized state, and, you know, our program has really thrived.
And
I'm just going to say that I'm also a labor attorney here in New Jersey, and some of what I teach are the employment and American labor law courses.
And we appreciate your efforts on that. It's unfortunately not enough schools and universities have labor programs. They've been converted. They've been, you know, defunded, so on and so forth. I'm glad to see Rutgers has a strong program still. You were on Fox News recently talking about the minimum wage. Tell us about that and what your thoughts were.
Well, I was actually asked to come on to talk about the pressure on President Obama to sign an executive order to raise federal contractor rates to $15 an hour. Of course, that swirled into a general discussion, as it often does, on the minimum wage. And, you know, there's clearly, you know, a lot of the more conservative stations like Fox are used as surrogates by some of our largest corporations like Walmart and Big Food. To sort of push the idea that raising the minimum wage is ostensibly a job killer, when that's just not the reality. And the American people are clearly sort of ahead of the game on this front, and that they have clearly become tired of feeling the economic pain, because we're seeing things that were fairly remarkable, like the most recent midterm elections, where four very Republican-leaning states elected Republicans and at the same time overwhelmingly chose to raise their minimum wages, and not by an insignificant margin. You know, in Arkansas in particular, where Walmart calls their home base, 65% of voters voted to raise the minimum wage. And Arkansas was one of the states that still had a state minimum that was below, $1 below the federal minimum wage. So now they will have a minimum wage of $8.50 by 2017. Not that that's any great shake, but what it does show is that the people of the country, workers of all political stripes, are feeling the economic pain and understand that we need to do something about it, to start to address the increasing income inequality and restore a thriving middle class. But that's good not just for individual people and their families, but it's also good for our economy, and it's good for the country as a whole.
Professor Katz, let me ask you this. You say that raising the minimum wage is good for our country, good for the people working. I agree with you, but there are people out there in the United States that will say this is a job killer. People will lose their job. Employers will cut back. the more people will be, or people will be doing more with less. What's your answer to that?
Well, the answer is to look around, because despite the fact that the federal minimum wage has not been raised, 29 states will have rates higher than the federal by January 2015. So in cities and in states where the minimum wage has been raised, and in some cases by very significant margins, that has not been the reality, that jobs have been lost. Those economies are thriving, and the states who have failed to raise their minimum wages are lagging behind the states that have actually done so. You know, that's sort of an easy argument to comprehend, but it's much more complicated than that. And, you know, we obviously need more than just to raise the minimum wage itself, because the bulk of Americans are not working at minimum wage. There are a huge number working at what we call near minimum wage, that would benefit from the $10.10 an hour that was proposed by the president and Congress that sort of withered this past summer with a lot of Republican opposition. But, you know, that would capture about 27 million Americans. But it also has the indirect effect, right? When the bottom is raised, all workers' salaries tend to go up. And as income inequality is just increasing so dramatically, you know, people don't have money in their pockets to spend.
Right.
So they need to be able to sort of do the basics first, food and shelter and emergencies, education, et cetera, and then have money to spend in the very stores that they're working. If they don't have that, we don't have an economy that thrives. I mean, one of the things that one of the Fox commentators said that was just silly on the show was that, well, you're suggesting that we give people more money and they're just going to give it back to the businesses they work for. Why would we do that? Why give them money in the first place?
Doesn't he understand
how the economy works?
Yeah,
they spend it. And move the economy forward.
Let me ask you a question. There are a number of big box stores and other food stores out there that practice this low wage business model. Maybe not minimum wage, but it's low wage. Mm-hmm. And they know full well that their employees are going to end up getting county assistance for food, for housing, for, you know, medical care. They know this, and they even help their employees go and make these applications to the county to get this money. And they're happy to do that because they figure, now I don't have to pay somebody $10, $12, $15 an hour.
Right.
But the county taxpayers do. They have to pay into these programs to supplement the income of these employees. Do you think we can figure out a way to have the county send a bill every quarter to these low-wage business plan big boxes so the taxpayers can recoup this money?
You know, that's a great idea. And you're right. You know, this sort of corporate welfare is a way that this sort of system of low-wage work and high-profit corporations keep going. Walmart's a great example of that. I mean, Walmart cost taxpayers $7.8 billion last year, and $6.2 billion of that was in federal subsidies because they don't pay their employees enough. That's money that got spent on food stamps, health care, and other public assistance that essentially the taxpayers are funding Walmart's ability to make $16 billion in profit. So as they made $16 billion in profit last year, we got a bill for $7.8 billion of that. That's just insane. That is not a workable long-term system. And the fact that, you know, there's a focus on this idea that they're job killers, the same folks that are out there talking about
how awful people living on welfare or taking food stamps are the same people that are out there supporting the idea that Walmart should be able to pay, and McDonald's, and not just picking on Walmart, all of them, are paying as little as humanly possible for their labor. And, you know, the system is untenable. And, you know, I'm happy to see the signs of a growing what feels like a popular movement across the country to make the change, you know, especially when we're seeing this come from both sides of the political spectrum in terms of people. So, you know, this week, hopefully on Black Friday, there should be protests at 1,600 Walmart stores. A couple of weeks ago, there were sit-down strikes in L.A. At Walmart. There have been tons of fast food strikes across the country. And, you know, I think combined with the living wage movement more generally that's looking as different pieces to raise the minimum wage, to push for living wage resolutions, to start bringing the issue of economic inequality more in focus, I think, you know, we're seeing a tipping point and the politicians need to catch up.
I agree with you, Professor. Professor Katz, let me ask you this. How can we find out more about you, what you write, and your program at Rutgers?
Well, you can find me online by just looking me up by name and at our school at Rutgers University, the School for Management and Labor Relations. And we've got a great website there. We've got classes for folks that are, you know, already have degrees or have no degree and just want to come and learn something about, you know, work in the economy.
And we appreciate that very much. I hope we can get you back on the show with us on a fairly regular basis. How's that?
I would love to do that.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. In the meantime, we've got to get going, but I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio.
My name is Dale Pazinski. I'm 19 years old, and this is how I live United. I've always been kind of a computer geek, and I found a way to use those skills to help the homeless in my community. For people facing hard times, computer skills and a basic resume are so important. It may seem like a small thing, but it makes a huge difference in people's lives. So with United Way, I created a program where I work with the homeless. Together, we go through their whole job history, write a resume, and then save it on their very own USB drive. We provide workbooks and training certificates. I even budgeted for cupcakes so we can celebrate as a class when one of our people gets a job. That's huge. When somebody says, "Hey man, that job that you helped me apply for, I got it." That's what living United feels like to me. My name is Dale Pazinski. I help people achieve financial independence. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org, brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
While the words you say,
this is Dave from the Dave Matthews Band for Rad. When you go out and party, get drunk, then drive, you're not only loaded, you're a loaded weapon. When you celebrate, designate. Choose a designated driver. Remember, music lives and so should you.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Hello?
Hi, I found your name on the internet. I'm going through a foreclosure. Can you help?
Sure, it's simple. We'll just leverage your transitory expenditures into a fiduciary trust, and we massage those assets before your money goes into my private account.
I don't get it.
If you're facing foreclosure, who should you trust? The HOPE Hotline is a free resource connecting you with HUD-approved housing counseling agencies available 24 hours a day who can give you the information and clarity you need. Call the HOPE Hotline at 888-995-HOPE. That's 888-995-4673. Brought to you by NeighborWorks America and the Ad Council.
We first opened about 10 years ago. We were small, just a few of us, but it was exciting. I always dreamt of having my own business. It was kind of slow at first, but things started picking up. We had big plans, but in our wildest dreams, we never, never thought we'd have this much work. Yeah, with so many businesses caught off guard by the storm, Reed Waste Management has never been busier.
What will become of your business after a disaster? Nearly two-thirds of businesses aren't prepared for an emergency. And 40% of businesses that experience a disaster never recover. Make an emergency plan now before it's too late. For a free online tool that helps you develop an emergency plan to keep your business up and running should disaster strike, visit ready.gov/business. Brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the American Red Cross, and the Ad Council.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you for tuning in. We appreciate that. Please follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just type in the Union Edge. Right now, we're being joined by Frank Emspach from Workers Independent News. Frank, welcome back.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Frank.
Exciting day today. I think many of us were watching last night for the announcement from Ferguson, and I believe that it really had impact. We'll see. I know I got a call early this morning from a major French newspaper asking what was going on. And I think that we in the labor movement have to really give some thought to the decision by the police, really, I think, the prosecutor, not to prosecute. Not because there was outright graft or anything like that. Who knows? I don't think that's worth exploring. But because the way in which the whole thing was conducted, basically, almost every single law enforcement expert said that the prosecutor treated this as a trial rather than as a probable cause issue. In other words, the beyond a shadow of a doubt standard rather than maybe we should investigate. But I think more importantly, the Ferguson verdict raised questions, and I think in many, many people's minds, about the whole criminal justice system. Because what we see here is basically not much happening to the policeman. I mean, he, in spite of all of the publicity, was able to go off and get married and apparently start a life someplace. But more importantly, more and more coverage began to come out about the way Ferguson was raising money, namely out of traffic tickets and then fining poor people. And then more and more newspapers began covering these bizarre sentencing things in Florida where people are getting arrested and then incarcerated for years. And finally, I think that you began, as a result of Ferguson, not because of this last decision, people began looking at the whole issue of low-level drug stuff, marijuana usage, the huge disparities between the way black people and white people are treated by the criminal justice system, even as the justice system operates step by step like it's supposed to. I think that's what's happening as a result of Ferguson.
I think that there is a definite difference in how law enforcement is perceived because of this. Being a former law enforcement officer, I got to tell you, I don't have any problem with the bright sunshine on a specific officer or a group of officers' actions. But at the same time, we have to counterbalance that with, we ask law enforcement officers to do some pretty heavy lifting for our communities in a number of different ways. And we ask them. Go ahead.
And we don't do it, and we don't, I think, support them in many ways. You see, I think there's that, and I agree with you. I feel that what happens is in these situations, people have not had sufficient training, they haven't had sufficient support, there is all kinds of glitches that happen, and then the person holding the bag is not the system, or not the captain, or not the police station, the police chief in general, but the guy on the beat. And it just strikes me that this is just not a good way to operate. I mean, I don't know whether that's what you had in mind, but I just think that the wrong guy is being held accountable here, although he should be accountable for something. But still, you know, there's a whole system in place that I think encourages certain types of behavior that people don't like, and that puts the officer in harm's way.
I think that there were some pretty systemic problems with the entire police department. And I'm not going to get into those right now, but there were some problems there. And it was a lack of leadership. And the community has the community has a responsibility there too.
Right, I think so. Chuck, I have to say something very serious here. I'm standing in the airport, and they're boarding my group. I think this is a very important discussion, and this plane is completely an hour late, so that's one of the problems here. So I've got to get on it. But I think the issue you raise is crucial, because we have to have something in place that people can respect and feel comfortable with. And if the actions of a whole system are such that nobody feels, or a large percentage of the population, both black and white, distrust it, then we're done as a society. And I think that's one of the issues that's coming out here in Ferguson.
I strongly believe that we have the ability to work our way through this, take the corrective actions, and work very hard to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen again. It's a process.
Well, I hope so.
It's a process and not a goal. But, Frank, you have a safe flight. We appreciate
right.
it. And we'll talk to you again soon. That was Frank Emspach of Workers Independent News. In the meantime, folks, we're going to transition over to Solidarity News. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio.
On the line, Mark Belange from Radio Labor, reporting for the Union Edge.
Today is the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. Labor organizations around the world are using the day to build greater awareness about violence against women in the workplace and what can be done about it. Rosa Pavanelli, the General Secretary of Public Services International, the PSI, told the media, "Violence against women at work is not merely the problem of the women who suffer, but of all of us. Violence against women is violence against society as a whole." Fred Van Leeuwen, the General Secretary of Education International, said, "Gender-based violence is a fundamental violation of human rights. It's one of the worst manifestations of gender-based discrimination and a major obstacle to achieving gender equality." Veronica Fernandez-Mendez is the head of the Equal Opportunities Department of UNI, the Global Union Federation for Skills and Services.
"Violence is a breach of women's human rights. We are talking about sexual assault, physical abuse, and verbal degradation. It is a global issue deeply rooted in the relation of power and inequality between women and men. We should keep it at the top of our agenda. We need to put all the resources needed to end this violence. What we notice is that violence against women, whether sexual, physical, mental, psychological, or economic, is a widespread phenomenon that affects millions of women. The lack of proper labor legislation exacerbates the vulnerability of women that are already at the margins of society."
The International Labor Organization, the ILO, is trying to get its member states to adopt a new convention about violence against women at work. A convention is a law which, if adopted, becomes part of a country's legislative infrastructure. Jane Hodges is with the ILO's Gender Bureau.
"The International Labour Organization is very interested to see our membership, representatives of governments, labour and business, looking to a possible International Labour Convention and recommendation on violence against women and men at work. We're hearing from our membership, 185 member states across all regions, that violence at work is on the rise. It's not just sexual harassment or daily inconveniences. It's becoming a very, very serious occupational safety and health issue. It's costing employers bucks because there's not only absenteeism and sickness claims, broken ribs, the bashed eye, but machinery also in a factory setting or on plantations is being destroyed. We're seeing also an incredible cost in stress, work-related stress, and eventually, in fact, we're seeing legal costs and so forth down the road. So employers and workers have a reason to have a new International Labour Convention."
The International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women has been declared by the United Nations. The UN is encouraging people to recognize the day by displaying the color orange in their communities. Daniel Dickinson of UN Radio reports,
"People around the world are being encouraged to display the color orange in their communities to symbolize hope for a future free from violence against women and girls. The Orange Your Neighborhood initiative is being launched by the UN to coincide with the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, which is marked annually on the 25th of November. Riet Groenen is from UN Women, the UN's gender-focused agency.
Violence against women is a very serious problem. It's a serious human rights violation. It's happening in every country in the world. It doesn't make a difference whether you're rich or poor, whether you're educated or not. It's really an experience which many, many women and girls unfortunately experience.
Violent acts against women are in most cases committed by an intimate partner. Of all women killed in 2012, almost half died at the hands of a partner or family member. The He for She campaign, launched earlier this year by UN Women, seeks to reverse that trend. Its aim is to engage men and boys as advocates of change for the achievement of gender equality and women's rights. The International Day kicks off 16 days of action against gender violence, which culminates on Human Rights Day on December the 10th.
And that's it. I'm C. Marie Ainsborough. Thank you for listening.